how I long to announce unto every spot on the surface of the earth and to carry to each one of its cities the glad tidings of this revelation. Those words of Baha'u'llah himself have inspired countless believers to leave their homes and to enter that special field of service, pioneering. Now, what does that call mean for us now as we strive to fulfill the aim of the 5-year plan, this latest chapter in the divine plan? Friends, there are so many aspects to the topic of pioneering. I will try to discuss a few major themes. Pioneering in the context of the framework of this plan, the needs of clusters, and some of the spiritual dimensions of pioneering, including the qualities of a pioneer. Now, in its pioneer call of 9 March 2007, the Universal House of Justice refers to the challenge of establishing 1,500 intensive programs of growth around the world. And it asks us, each one of us, to consider what our participation will be in this mighty enterprise. So the House of Justice in that message is, when it refers to this mighty enterprise, it is speaking of achieving this goal of 1,500 intensive programs of growth. And that is what the context for this talk is and why we have that title for this evening's presentation. Pioneering, whether on the home front or internationally, is clearly linked to the systematic moving of clusters and to achieving this goal of intensive programs of growth. Now, you know, sometimes when we speak to the pilgrims or when we're traveling, believers come up to us afterwards, after talks or whatever, and often I've been asked the question anyway, or they say, we understand that pioneering isn't important anymore. What they're usually referring to is international pioneering. Well, just to give one perspective, we can go back to this statement from Shoghi Effendi, which was in Citadel of Faith, where he said, "The flow of pioneers will presage and hasten the advent of the day, which will witness the entry by troops of peoples of diverse nations and races into the Baha'i world." So the Guardian makes the connection between the flow of pioneers and entry by troops. But we can look at some statements, very recent statements of the Universal House of Justice that are extremely relevant to this question. In the message of 27 December 2005, which, as you know, is the blueprint for our 5-year plan, the House of Justice, near the end of the message, discusses the various measures that are needed, the methods and instruments, in order to advance the clusters, advance the process of systematic growth. And then it says this: equally important will be the support lent to a cluster through an influx of pioneers. So that, I think, answers the question about whether it's important. Equally important will be the support lent to a cluster through an influx of pioneers. Then the message goes on to say this: we cherish the hope that many will be moved to render this meritorious service during the next plan, which means now, whether on the home front or in the international field, an act that in itself attracts untold blessings. Well, we'll speak later about the blessings. So often when we hear these phrases, all we can think of are all those blessings, all those bounties. But we have to, each of us, carefully consider whether, in fact, the way in which we can best serve the faith, and specifically the aim of this global plan, is by becoming a home front or international pioneer. You know, all through our lives, in making decisions, our service to the cause should be the context for those decisions. I'm not telling you anything new. Obviously, that's the whole underlying philosophy and purpose of the Serving the Divine Plan program. And tomorrow, you're going to hear presentations on life of service, if you haven't already. But I just think it highlights the importance of consulting with institutions of the faith, with family and friends, so that we can make the best choices with regard to the opportunities before us in serving the faith. Then, if through personal reflection and consultation, we decide that we can arise to pioneer, the House of Justice advises us in this way, again from the 9 March 2007 call for pioneers. If you haven't read that, you certainly should. Friends responding to the call for pioneers are encouraged to turn to the institutions as a first step. Okay, not when you have your ticket and you're heading on the plane. As a first step, it says. This will help them determine where their services can be most effectively directed. So it seems two key questions are, is pioneering the right service for me at this time? And if so, where can I best be utilized? Now, as we could see from the excerpt from the 27 December message, pioneering is important. But we have to also think about the fact that there are new circumstances and new requirements in relation to pioneering. You know, in a sense, I think when the House of Justice talked about that new state of mind at the beginning of the four-year plan that was required on the part of institutions and believers in relation to growth and administration, I think it applies to pioneering also. One thing we can be sure of is that pioneering should fit into our framework for action. And in the earlier chapters of the Divine Plan, there were different dimensions and emphases to pioneering, and that's very much the case now. The House of Justice, in that same 27 December message, which you're all very familiar with, of course, integrates pioneering into the framework of action. It explains it in this way. The institutions will have to exercise sound judgment to ensure that such friends, those who arise, are strategically placed. Now, if you look up strategic in the dictionary, doing something in a strategic manner means that it fits into a long-term plan and that it achieves a specific purpose. So the House of Justice is saying that the friends have to be strategically placed. It then goes on to say, priority should be given to settling short-term and long-term pioneers in those clusters that are the focus of systematic attention, whether as a means of reinforcing endeavors to lay the groundwork for accelerated growth or stabilizing cycles of activity underway. Now, what I understand that to mean that pioneers are needed in the so-called A clusters to further their activities and to contribute toward their sustainability, and also in the B and the C clusters that have been targeted to launch intensive programs of growth by 2011. So it seems to me, in order to be strategically placed, one has to understand the priorities in a particular country, particularly if we're thinking of international pioneering, and at the same time, understand the various approaches and methods that are needed in order to advance or develop A, B, and C clusters. Again, that's why I think it's important to consult with your institutions, the relevant counselor, auxiliary board members, National Assembly, because there is a systematic process for how these clusters are advancing. And I think without this kind of input, it would be difficult for individual Baha'is to know where they could be used in the best way and where the needs are the greatest at a particular time and what those needs specifically are. Now I have to take a short break for what we call an infomercial. I think that's what they're called. Because I want to tell you about a particular document which was released by the House of Justice, I think, in the late spring of this year, called the Document of Pioneering Needs. And it was prepared by the Teaching Center at the request of the Universal House of Justice, which has happened, of course, in past plans as well. And this document, which is about an 85-page document, was sent out to all counselors and national assemblies, is available here for you to look at the various libraries, such as the Pilgrim House and PRC and so on. But the thing about this document, you'll see, is that it's all about clusters. Of course, the countries are listed there that need pioneers, and there are over 150 countries included in the document. But within those countries, it's very explicit as to what are the particular needs in order to advance the clusters that are receiving the focus of systematic attention. So when you study that document, and it's very, I think, helpful even for home front pioneers, if your country is listed in that document, it's a very good, gives a very good description of what the needs are for different clusters, possibly in your own particular country, which would also give you some insight into the home front pioneering needs. But you'll see that you can get an idea, well, what, you know, besides the particular clusters that are in need of assistance, what kind of assistance do they need? Do they need more children's class teachers? Are they trying to get junior youth groups underway and they need more animators? Of course, every cluster needs good teachers of the faith. But what does that mean to you in practical terms? If, for example, you haven't had much experience in direct teaching, say, as we learned through Rui Institute Book 6, then maybe that's something you want to give some attention to and focus on when you go back to your home countries. If you've had a lot of experience in an A cluster, an intensive program of growth, and participating in expansion phases and teaching teams, then you maybe have some valuable experience that you can bring to a cluster that you will pioneer to. So I think the other thing you'll notice when you see this document, and I think it's a good reference work, is that it reflects what the House of Justice advised in its message of 9 January 01 at the beginning of the last five-year plan. And that is the centrality of the institute process. That comes through in the document. When speaking of home front pioneers, the House of Justice wrote this: goals will be met with relative ease if pioneers are experienced in institute programs and are able to use their methods and materials in raising up a group of dedicated believers who can carry the work of the faith forward in the area. In its pioneering call the next year, which is January 02, the House of Justice wrote this about international pioneers. Their participation will be especially effective in the programs of growth spreading throughout the world if they have developed abilities to foster the institute process. Well, the message seems loud and clear. Whether a home front or an international pioneer, you'll probably be more effective if you have completed the sequence of courses and can initiate core activities, have the skills to enable you to implement the framework of the plan. Now, does that mean if you haven't completed the sequence of courses, you can't go pioneering? No, I didn't say that. So don't go away from here and say, well, Penny Walker said that we can't go pioneering if we haven't finished the sequence of courses. I'm always amazed at the things people remember from my talks, particularly when I didn't even say them. But, you know, the importance of training, of course, is also balanced with certain statements in the writings about how this area of service is open to all, in a sense. And Shoghi Effendi, when he wrote, of course, during the time of the plans that he oversaw, in many passages, in the calls to pioneers, he would say, you know, however humble your origins, however limited your experience, and so on. So that aspect is there. Now, if you need financial assistance in order to go pioneering, then that's something else. Because very likely the sending country from which you're going is looking for certain kinds of experience, and when they identify people to recommend to the receiving country. And obviously the receiving country, as I said from the document of needs, has some very specific ideas of the kinds of pioneers that would be very much of assistance to them. And then there's the Continental Pioneering Committee that of course looks to see whether there can be financial assistance. I just mention that because sometimes, you know, letters come in or you hear people talking about the fact, well, I want to go to that country over there and I have this very important project that I want to carry out there, and I need about $5,000 to do it, And it doesn't quite work that way. So there's a process you go through, and there are, of course, criteria to meet if, in fact, there are finances involved. If you're self-supporting, of course, you have more latitude, but still, you would want to take the guidance of the House of Justice about pioneering in this plan very much to heart. And as I said, the House of Justice has made some very specific points in terms of the fact that pioneers should be strategically placed and they should be able to promote the institute process. You will also see in the document where different countries request pioneers with rather specialized skills, say in external affairs or statistics and so on. But of course, these friends also will be more effective, I think, if they understand how what they're doing reinforces other elements of the framework of the plan. Now, most of you will leave here probably having completed the sequence of courses. Many of you have already done so. The thing is, as you well know, here at the World Center, we are somewhat divorced from the action in the field. So it's very important to go back and get firsthand experience. I think for many people, or most people really, what we need to do is go back to our home cluster and get very involved in that cluster and learn things not just from the theory, but actually in action before we go pioneering, even on the home front. Because as you well know, just taking courses is not enough. We have to put that learning into action. If you have a great deal of experience, and maybe you came here with it, or after gaining some, then maybe the question that you want to decide is whether to pioneer on the home front or internationally. And there are a lot of factors to consider. One is the cluster that you live in, what kind of cluster you're living in. And I'm not talking about Haifa, obviously. It's not a cluster. I'm talking about in your home country. Also, your family circumstances, your job prospects in another area, your financial position, your educational goals. All these things are things that you have to consult about and reflect on. But if, for example, when I say the kind of cluster you're living in, if in your home country you're living in a cluster that is not one of the clusters targeted to achieve an intensive program of growth by the end of the plan, then it may be that if you move to a priority cluster, this depends, of course, on your own situation and so on, if you move to a priority cluster to strengthen an existing intensive program of growth, or to help launch a new one, then you could be performing a very important service, and it might fill a specific home front pioneering goal in your country. For those of you who at home live in an A cluster, there's also a home front pioneering opportunity often within that cluster, in addition to those that might be in other clusters. And what I mean by that is that in some A clusters, it can be of great help if believers move to another part of that cluster where the process of growth isn't so much underway. Take an urban cluster with many sectors. To move to another sector of your city can be a very fulfilling and important pioneering home front pioneering goal. I know in my travels, what I've sometimes noticed is that often the areas or neighborhoods in a city or areas in a cluster where very receptive populations live, we don't have Baha'is that live there. And I mean, that's not an impossible situation, but obviously it's easier to build up the underlying process of growth in an area when you have Baha'is resident there. Granted, it may be quite a sacrifice to move to another part of your city. It's less convenient for work, it's less convenient maybe for school, it's not as an attractive part of the city as what you're used to or whatever, but I don't know, Baha'is are often ready to move to the outer reaches of the planet, or they say they are, but find it difficult to move a few miles down the road, and that can often be a very great service. So my main point is that home front pioneering is a high priority in this plan. And it's also, if you have in your long-term vision or your short-term vision the desire to pioneer internationally, in the foreign fields, it's a very good experience to help build up a community and gain that experience before you go to another country. Now, before discussing some of the spiritual dimensions of pioneering, I just wanted to say something else about the call for pioneers in this plan, and specifically what's described in the document of needs. As I said, the countries are categorized, and they're, well, the categories are very easy to remember. We gave them easy names. We call them 1, 2, 3, and 4. First, you should understand that one category is not more urgent in terms of the pioneering needs than another category. In other words, category one is not the most pressing needs and category four the least. That's not how the descriptions of the categories are written. They're quite different from years past, and it's important to read those categories because it gives you a kind of the broad context of the conditions and needs of particular countries. And then the second thing you'll notice is that not all countries are in the document. There are over 150 countries or around that number, but not all of them are there. Now, for example, some of them are not included in the document because, traditionally speaking, we would not call them what we might refer to as receiving countries. In other words, countries like the United States and Germany, the United Kingdom, Australia, Canada, those are not countries for international pioneering goals. So if those were at the top of your list, you can just cross those off. Now, some of you will see that the country that you're from or that you live in, whether it's Bolivia or India or Ghana or Fiji, those countries are in the document. And as I said, there's a good deal of information there. You might say that to yourself, well, wherever I go when I leave here, I will serve. And of course, that's true, I'm sure. For one thing, whatever cluster we live in, whether we go pioneering or not, whatever cluster we live in, we should know what to do because we have the framework for action in how to promote a process of systematic growth. We know how to serve. And of course, I'm speaking to an audience for whom service to the faith is very important. But I feel, and this is just my personal understanding, that our service to the cause is elevated to a higher level when sacrifice is involved. And for some of you, the greatest sacrifice will be to return to your home country. Now, one of the things, as I mentioned, as you'll see in the document of needs, and in just in general in what has been written about pioneering in relation to this plan, of course, is that we're not just heading out anywhere. Just in the same way that the process of advancing the clusters is a systematic one, so is the placement of pioneers. And so people are not heading out to a lot of different D clusters around the world, to the jungles of South America or to the steppes of Russia and so on. The focus of pioneering is different from earlier years, as in a sense is our approach to growth. In other words, in the earlier plans, the watchword, you might say, was dispersal. All right. In fact, Shoghi Effendi wrote, "Let us scatter to the utmost corners of the earth." And the friends dispersed widely within their countries and around the world, and that's how we became the second most widespread faith, most widespread religion in the world. And that was very important. But now, as the House of Justice said at the beginning of the last five-year plan, the object is to achieve the penetration of a cluster, to increase the number of avowed believers in an area, and to create a pattern of activity that fosters sustained growth. But even with this distinction, you might say, between the earlier plans and now our approach and emphasis in this plan, the act of arising to pioneer, the spirit that motivates it, is fundamentally the same. And the House of Justice expressed it this way, again in the 27 December message. "The desire to pioneer arises naturally from deep within the heart of the individual believer as a response to the divine summons. So we respond to the call of Baha'u'llah, as I said at the beginning, and to the many inspiring appeals of Abdu'l-Bahá in the Tablets of the Divine Plan, which is the master plan for the spiritual conquest of the planet. You know, in the Priceless Pearl, where Ruhi Khanum says that Shoghi Effendi used to speak about plans and more plans, and then there was the plan. And that's the master's plan, which he referred to as the unique and grand design. And of course, there are so many wonderful passages in the Tablets of the Divine Plan. But this is one, of course, that has reached into the hearts of so many believers through the decades and motivated them to arise. "Oh, that I could travel," wrote Abdu'l-Bahá, "even though on foot and in the utmost poverty, to these regions, and raising the call of Ya Baha'u'llah Bahá in cities, villages, mountains, deserts, and oceans, promote the divine teachings. This, alas, I cannot do. How intensely I deplore it. Please, God, ye may achieve it." And of course, inspiring calls like this are what led to the sacrificial pioneering and travel teaching efforts of early teachers, exemplary souls like Martha Root and Marian Jack. And of course, these writings were the backdrop for the many stirring appeals made by Shoghi Effendi when he began the systematic prosecution of the master's grand design in his second seven-year plan, and then ultimately the greatest pioneering campaign of all, the 10-year world crusade. You know, one could spend a whole weekend talking about the 10-year crusade, but no talk on pioneering can happen without speaking about that crusade. The Guardian referred to it as the epochal, global, spiritual, decade-long crusade. At no other time in Baha'i history was there such a compelling call to arise, nor was there such an outstanding response. There are so many messages from Shoghi Effendi during these years to address to the believers and encouraging them and inspiring them to arise. Here's one brief one. He wrote, "I appeal to members of all communities to arise and enlist in the army of Baha'u'llah's crusaders ere the present opportunity is irretrievably lost." In another wonderful passage from Citadel of Faith, which, as you know, contains some of Shoghi Effendi's last messages to the American Baha'i community, Shoghi Effendi wrote to the believers and said that there were legions in the Abha kingdom waiting to pour forth their celestial strength on those who would arise to participate in the 10-year crusade. And then he continued in the letter. He said, "It is therefore imperative for the individual American believer, particularly the affluent, the independent, and the comfort-loving." Well, I'll tell you, friends, when I read this, I knew he was addressing me. Seriously, there was no escaping it. In the 9 January message of the House of Justice, 9 January 2001, we also read these inspiring words from the House of Justice about homefront pioneering. "Precious indeed will be the privilege of those who in the remaining years of the first century of the formative age place their trust in God and arise with fervor to take the lead in carrying the divine guidance to every part of their countries." And then the message went on to say that the home front pioneers must be raised up in that same consecrated spirit that prompted those who scattered abroad at earlier times to open virgin territories across continents and seas. Not necessarily the same approaches, but that same consecrated spirit. Well, as I said, there was no better example of that spirit than the 10-year crusade. And as you know, it extended from 1953 to 1963. Shoghi Effendi died in the middle of that plan. And as we were reminded really in that beautiful message that the House of Justice released recently at the time of the passing of Dr. Varga. It was the hands of the cause, the chief stewards of the Baha'i Commonwealth that led us to a victorious conclusion of that plan. And Dr. Varga himself, who traveled tirelessly to promote the goals, to fulfill those goals of that plan. And the stories of the Knights of Baha'u'llah, you know, the individuals who were the first to open a country to the faith, will be a source of inspiration for believers and, of course, for pioneers for generations to come. You know, each account of theirs in opening a particular country, the obstacles they faced, the challenges, the humor, each one is really an inspiring story unto itself. You know, to try to understand what that consecrated spirit was that the House of Justice refers to, first, we want to think about the magnitude of the challenge in that plan. One way to think about it is sort of what was achieved. When Shoghi Effendi gave that plan to the Baha'i world in 1953, there were only 12 national spiritual assemblies. Shoghi Effendi describes himself what happened in the first period of the plan. He wrote that in its history, the Baha'i faith, in its first 100 years of history, the Baha'i faith had spread to 78 countries in the first 100 years. And in the first year of the 10-year crusade, in that single year, it spread to 100 more. So you can just imagine the outpouring of energy and spirit and devotion that were associated with that plan and the spirit of sacrifice. Of course, the pioneers took as their source of inspiration and courage, which is what so many of them demonstrated. They came from words like this from Baha'u'llah in the gleanings: "They that have forsaken their country for the purpose of teaching our cause, these shall the faithful spirit strengthen through its power. A company of our chosen angels shall go forth with them." And when you read some of their stories and experiences, you feel that a company of chosen angels must have been going forth with some of these believers in what they were able to achieve. Of course, they were also galvanized by the vision of Shoghi Effendi for that plan, because this was the plan that was going to make us a world faith, a truly global faith, and that's what was achieved. And by 1963, not only had the faith spread to more than 200 countries, but there were 44 more national spiritual assemblies. But I want to just share with you one story of one of these Knights of Baha'u'llah. And it's a story that some of you have probably already heard. And I've, of course, heard it told to me many times before I went pioneering. And once when I heard it from a hand of the cause, he said, "This is a story that is to be told and retold. And so I'm going to share it with you." And it's the story of the believer who was the oldest believer to arise during the 10-year crusade, and that was Ella Bailey. Now, Ella Bailey was a Baha'i in California. She was born in the area of Berkeley. That's where she grew up, and she suffered from polio at the age of 2 or 3 years old, so that her entire life, one of her legs was paralyzed. She became a Baha'i in about 1905. The teacher was Lua Getzinger. And in 1912, in fact, she, with other friends, went to Wilmette. She met Abdu'l Baha, and she was there for the laying of the cornerstone. She was very active all her life. She was a school teacher. She didn't marry. She was, for years, chairman of the local assembly of Berkeley. She's remembered when people write about her. They say that she was a modest, unassuming person, but always with a smile on her face. Well, when The Guardian announced the 10-year crusade in 1953, she was already 88 years old. But she went with some friends from her community to this conference in Wilmette in 1953, which was one of the sort of launching points for this plan. And she came back so excited, and as I said, everybody wanted to be part of this plan of the and part of the crusade. Now, two friends, a husband and wife in her community, were already preparing to go to a pioneering post to open the country, to go to Tripoli, to open Libya, and had received approval from Shoghi Effendi. They could see how much Ella had been affected by the conference and knew what was in her heart. She was too modest to really ask or to say anything. So they offered and they said, "Ella, would you like to go with us when we go to our pioneering post?" And of course she was thrilled. But then she said, oh, she felt she would be a burden and she didn't want to be a burden. And they said, "No, we're sure it's all right, but we'll just send a message to Shoghi Effendi and see what he says." And he immediately cabled back and said, "Approve, Bailey accompany you." Mm-hmm. So Ella was very excited and was making preparations. Well, her friends in her community, some of the other friends said, "Ella, you know, when the Guardian is giving these goals, he's not thinking of people like you, Ella. You know, you're not in any condition to do this." And what happened then was that Ella actually took sick, and she came down with pneumonia and was put in a nursing home. And the friends went to visit her, and they said, "Ella, this is a sign. Really, you're not in any condition to go pioneering. You should stay back and pray for others. You're just going to sacrifice all your health." But Ella was determined, and she told them, "Well, I don't find it any sacrifice to leave this nursing home." So Ella recuperated and went to the traveled with this couple, and they went first to New York City. Well, as it happened, in New York City, Ella took a bad fall, and again she was bedridden. Now, while she was bedridden, she got a visit from Hand of the Cause of God, Mr. Khadem, and in fact, he wrote that the New York City local assembly was already preparing a memorial service for Ella Bailey because they just didn't see how she was going to make it, you know. You know, friend, just think about it now, friends. Just think if you were with her, if you were in her community back at that time, back in Berkeley, California, what would you have said to Ella Bailey? See, you know, one of the things that's very hard, I think, in life to really discern is what's a sign and what's a test. So Ella passed that test and went on, okay? Other friends thought it was a sign to stop. So when Ella found out that she had no fracture, she decided she was ready to go on, and she and her friends flew to Italy and then flew to Tripoli. Well, 1 month later, after reaching Tripoli, Ella Bailey passed away. And Shoghi Effendi sent a cable to the National Assembly of the United States, saying, "Grieve at passing a valiant, exemplary pioneer, reward in kingdom bountiful." He also wrote a letter and said that he had elevated her to the rank of martyr in the faith, and that he personally would attend to her monument, that she have a befitting monument, and he would pay for it himself. Well, after he wrote that letter, Leroy Ioas, and this is in the biography of Leroy Ioas, Leroy Ioas approached Shoghi Effendi and said, "Shoghi Effendi, may I tell you a little story about Ella Bailey?" He said, "When I was treasurer of the National Spiritual Assembly of the United States, we had to raise $1 million for the external ornamentation of the House of Worship in Wilmette. And so I went traveling to try to do this, and I went out to California to raise money, and Ella invited me to come to tea. And she said to me, 'You know, I have put some money aside for my travel and service, and I've also put some money aside, $150, which of course over 50 years ago was quite a good sum, for my burial expenses. But you know, I really don't need that money for my burial expenses. I can just be buried in a potter's field," in other words, a field for the poor. And Leroy said, "Oh, Ella," he said, "we have to raise $1 million. I don't need to take this $150 from you." But no, she said, my mind is made up. You please take this as my contribution in this stage of the campaign. Well, when Shoghi Effendi heard this story, he was very moved, according to Leroy. Now, he didn't know that before he had himself said that he was going to cover the cost of her monument. But Leroy Ayoa said, you know, to him it was such a lesson in the mystery of sacrifice, that here she had given up any concern about her own burial and what that might be like. And ultimately, as it turned out, that her monument was going to be purchased and attended to by Shoghi Effendi, the sign of God on earth. And the next year, at the Intercontinental Conference, where the friends celebrated the victories of the first year, Shoghi Effendi sent this cable. Irresistibly unfolding crusade, sanctified by the death of heroic 88-year-old Ella Bailey, elevating her rank martyr's faith, shedding further luster American Baha'i community, and consecrating the soil of the fast awakening African continent. So friends, the spiritual dimensions of pioneering are something that we can't really understand, but Shoghi Effendi saw this at a very profound level and wrote this beautiful cable. And in The Priceless Pearl, Rahia Khanum tells us that on Shoghi Effendi's, you know, very detailed and beautiful map of the 10-year crusade, he put a gold star at Tripoli, and he told her, that's Ella Bailey. The pioneers knew that the guardian was with them all the time. Leroy Ayoas wrote a letter to some pioneers, and he wrote this. When Shoghi Effendi learned of difficulties facing some pioneers, he was grieved. I'm telling you this so you know the guardian's heart is with you every moment, every second. And Shoghi Effendi penned a beautiful tribute to the pioneers of the 10-year crusade, one that reflected his deep feelings for them. He said, to the band of pioneers, whether settlers or itinerant teachers, who have forsaken their homes, who have scattered far and wide, who have willingly sacrificed their comfort, their health, and even their lives for the prosecution of this plan, I myself, as well as the entire Baha'i world, owe a debt of gratitude that no one can measure or describe. And as you know, of course, the names of the Knights of Baha'u'llah are inscribed on a scroll of honor and placed under the threshold in the shrine of Baha'u'llah at the instruction of Shoghi Effendi, that Shoghi Effendi had left. You know, Rahia Khanum was the same way in the sense of her support for the pioneers. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with her book called Manual for Pioneers. I think she wrote that because the pioneers were so close to her heart. She had such a level of empathy for them, and she was so supportive of them. She wrote many personal letters to pioneers, and she said, I remember before the team left on the Greenlight expedition, she said that she was making that film to inspire believers to pioneer. She said, if only they can see the beauty of the places, if only they can see the beauty of the people, and if they can see that if I can go there, so can they. She said, the Baha'is have no shortage of devotion and no shortage of enthusiasm, but what they often lack is imagination, to imagine themselves someplace else. So what do you need to pioneer? What does Baha'u'llah say is the best provision for our journey as a pioneer or as an itinerant teacher? He said, when one determineth to leave his home for the sake of the cause of his Lord, let him put his whole trust in God as the best provision for his journey and array himself with the robe of virtue. Reliance on God. First, of course, you'll need that spirit of pioneering, that passion that'll get you to get up and go, to arise. But once you leave your home, you will need reliance and trust in God. And sometimes that is the main thing that you have. You know, I think in the pioneering field, certain words and phrases of the prayers somehow take on a very deep meaning for you in a way sometimes they didn't before. And I always think of the one about clinging to the cord of his love. Sometimes you feel that that's what you're doing. You're clinging to that cord. In the Tablets of the Divine Plan, Abdu'l-Bahá wrote about another kind of trust, and he expressed it so beautifully. He was addressing again the teachers and pioneers, said, "Let them press forward, each according to his strength and resources, placing their whole trust in the matchless potency of Baha'u'llah's teachings." What we have as Baha'is, no one else has. The revelation of God for this day, the teachings for personal, community, and global transformation. So we place our trust in God and in his teachings. Now, the second part of that quote from Baha'u'llah was, "Array yourself with the robe of virtue." And I think, of course, there's so many passages you're familiar with, not just about pioneers, but about teachers of the faith in general, that we adorn ourselves with the ornament of a goodly conduct, of upright and praiseworthy character, and so on, so that our words may attract the hearts of the hearer. There's a beautiful passage that Baha'u'llah wrote to a believer who leaves his home to teach the faith. He said, "Let trust in God be his shield, and reliance on God his provision, and the fear of God his raiment. Let patience be his helper, and praiseworthy conduct his succorer, and goodly deeds his army." Shoghi Effendi wrote a great deal about this, that the pioneers should be distinguished, he said, for the sanctity of their morals and the incorruptibility of their character. Just think about it. If you're going to a new area or to a new country, how great your influence can be if your character is incorruptible. And think about your influence if it's the reverse. And I think this is something we have to think about, you know. We have to look at things seriously. We have to, as it says in one place, we have to know ourselves. And if we are going through a lot of difficulties and have a lot of problems, or we have marital problems or whatever it might be, don't take those to the other end. Going to the other end of the world is not going to solve them. Don't take those to another community. You know, I'm remembering from Dr. Javahari's talk last month on protecting the cause of God, where he talked about the fact that we as individuals have responsibility to protect the cause. One of the things is through our own behavior. And that's so very important when you go into the pioneering field. And frankly, friends, that sometimes it takes years. I mean, pioneers can bring great blessings to community, you know, and great support. But sometimes it takes years for a community to recover from certain pioneers. Sorry, I have to be so frank, but I mean, but seriously, from their lack of wisdom, from their personal crises, from their misbehavior or their domination. And that's why, as I said, we have to meditate and reflect upon the guidance and upon the writings and see if this is the right arena of service for us. What else do you need for pioneering? Well, throughout the writings, I think there's mention of a few other important things: steadfastness, perseverance. If you're going long-term pioneering, not even long-term pioneering, sometimes short-term pioneering, and even home front or international, things aren't always going to be so easy. There will be a lot of challenges. You'll learn a lot of the prayers for tests and difficulties. Even if you grew up in pioneering families, very likely you didn't go through the same struggles that your parents went through. They often went through those struggles and made those sacrifices so that things would be a bit easier for you. And I said, home from pioneering, there can be challenges. You think about if you're in India and you're going home from pioneering from, say, a cluster in Kerala, up to Darjeeling, it's going to be a big challenge. There's a lot of differences. It's like going to another country. It's a different language. It's a different climate. It's a different culture, a different cuisine, I should say, maybe, rather than culture. But there are challenges even moving sometimes within your own country, in addition to when you go to into the international field. I imagine there will be a number of times that you'll say, where were all those bounties we were promised? But I don't know, I think that, and I think probably a lot of people who have been pioneers would say that 90% of the challenges and difficulties you face can often be solved through perseverance. And you know, one of the things that Shoghi Effendi emphasized so much in his letters, and of course later Rehya Khanum, was the importance of staying at your post. This was something that was very much, of course, in the ethos of the early plans, and then of the early plans of the House of Justice as well. And so many letters from Shoghi Effendi written on behalf of the Guardian touch on this. But I just want to read one excerpt, because this very much, I think, was in the thinking of so many pioneers that went out in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Each pioneer must feel his responsibility very heavily and understand that his calling is far above the average service and his duty to remain at his post a very pressing one indeed. Now, I'd like to just tell two short little stories that I think give a feeling of this idea of remaining at your post. We had some American friends who were Knights of Baha'u'llah to a country in Europe, and they had quite a good situation there in that the husband was teaching at a college, at the local college where they settled, and everything was going fine. And then he got a notice from the Selective Service, which is the draft, which in the United States means that's when they had the conscription, and he was drafted into the armed services, and he had to leave within so many months. So they were heartsick about this, but they immediately sort of got into gear and found some friends back in the States who were willing to take their place, not only in that very town, but the husband of this other couple was also a professor, and he would be taking that same position that this pioneer was vacating. So they were so relieved, and they immediately wrote to Shoghi Effendi and said how, you know, regrettable it was that they were going to have to leave, but this is what they had arranged. They got a cable back from Shoghi Effendi right away which said, to remain at your post until the new pioneers come, so as not to break the spiritual continuity of pioneering. And they said that stayed with them for a long, long time, what the significance of that was. I'll tell you one other little short story that I think also illustrates this point. And this one, I heard from Rehya Khanum directly, and she talked about the fact that Shoghi Effendi used to carry in his breast pocket a little black book where he had all the names of the pioneers, this is during the 10-year crusade, all the names of the pioneers in their countries and so on. He knew where everyone was, and he kept that here. And one night at dinner, I think it was Mr. Iois, I can't recall, but came in and said that from the correspondence that day he had learned, and he told this at the table, that two pioneers had to leave their posts. And so Shoghi Effendi took out his little book, and he crossed out a name, and then he put it back in. And Rehya Khanum said, Shoghi Effendi, Mr. Leroy said there were two pioneers that had to leave their posts. And he said, I think one is all I can manage for one day. So you prepare yourself for pioneering through reliance on God, through exemplifying, just striving to exemplify the virtues. What should you take with you? Well, I asked that question, it's kind of a rhetorical question, but I asked it, and before I could answer myself, in one seminar I was in, someone said, are Rui books? I said, well, that's a good answer, but I was thinking of some intangibles. In the Manual for Pioneers, Rehya Khanum talks about taking love, fellowship, kindliness, and goodwill. You know, it reminds me of that that short prayer for teaching, that lovely prayer for teaching from Abdu'l-Bahá, which begins, "Aid thou thy trusted servants." You know that short prayer? And then it goes on and it says, "Help them to spread among all the nations the light of guidance." Well, the way it begins is, "Aid thou thy trusted servants to have loving and tender hearts." Help them to spread among all the nations the light of guidance. First comes the love. And Hand of the Cause, Dr. Mahajir, used to say, you have to love the people to teach the people. Ruhia Khanum closed this section about important qualities and attributes to take in pioneering with the importance of unity. First and foremost, she said, be a source of unity. Certainly what they don't need when you go to a new cluster or you go to another country is to take contention. You know, in the Institution of the Counselors, the House of Justice says we have to strive to combat the age-old habit of conflict and contention and criticism. That's not what we want to take. We want to take unity. We want to be a source of unity. Unity is like the sun. We say so powerful is the light of unity, it can illumine the whole earth. Unity has a life-giving effect on everything. And without unity, things wither and die. You know, other important qualities for all of us as teachers or pioneers is detachment, humility. I think a watchword when you go to your home from pioneering or international pioneering post is to listen and learn. You go there to assist, to support, not to change everything the way people are doing things. You know, to a certain extent, you're a guest in that country, even if you're there for years and years. When you go to someone's house as a guest, you start changing all the furniture around and saying it should be this way and it should be that way. I think we all have to, in the pioneering field, really think about and strive to let the local people develop and come to the forefront. That's another thing that Dr. Mahajir used to say, was that pioneers should be as the wind in the sails. So we go as servants to the community and not striving to be leaders. When to pioneer, that's another question. Well, again, if you read what Ruhi Khanum has written, you know, she said that the opportunities before us now may not be there tomorrow. And some of the services we can render now will not even be possible in some years ahead. And that's very true, of course. I mean, there's a lot of truth to that. But also, you know, each of us has to really reflect on this on our own, or if we're married as a couple or a family, we have to make our own individual decision. And sometimes we can look at our life of service in phases. And now you're serving here, there's a chance to go back to your home communities, serve in your own cluster, gain experience. Maybe there's a phase in your Baha'i service for home from pioneering, and maybe there's a phase for international pioneering. For others, that vision and that passion for international pioneering has sort of always been there, and they're ready to act on it now. But this is something that we have to really reflect on and decide for ourselves as individuals. You know, at the time of the Shoghi Effendi and his global plans, and this account is given in Priceless Pearl, he said, you know, he hoped that the friends didn't feel that he was personally putting pressure on them. He said, there is no pressure other than the pressure of historical circumstances. Isn't that what we have now? You know, sometimes I see that image in my mind of that statement that the Guardian wrote, of the sands of a chaotic, despairing civilization are running out. The sands are running out. So there's that pressure of historical circumstances. There's another kind of pressure that I know we feel at the Teaching Center, and that's this goal of 1,500 intensive programs of growth. And as you may know, the House of Justice has written to all to national assemblies, and most of them have international pioneering goals. I think the goals at this point, the call numbers over 3,500, over 3,500 that are needed at this stage. And of course, the goals for homefront pioneering are even more extensive. As I mentioned earlier, when you leave here, I think it's very important to translate all the theory you're learning into action and to really immerse yourselves in the activities of the plan in your cluster or in another cluster in your country. You know, become a tutor or start teaching children's classes. Try to understand in action all the dimensions of this framework. If you live in a country like the United States or Australia, Canada, or whatever, you probably can be spared to go international pioneering, and they have quite a few international pioneering goals. They also have extensive homefront pioneering goals. Now, if you are in a if you live in a country, if you're from a country that's listed in the Document of Needs that has definite need for more pioneers, say Russia or Ghana or Nepal or wherever, then I think you'll want to consult, as I said, with your institutions, with your board members, with your assemblies, and so on, as to where you might be needed most. Also, you should feel free to meet with members of the International Teaching Center if you want to discuss certain parts of the world or certain pioneering goals that you're interested in. I don't know if I'm opening the floodgate on that. I go out of town next week, but all my colleagues will be here. You know, pioneers can bring a lot of capabilities and talents to a place. They can achieve a tremendous number of things. But if you're from one of these countries that is listed in the Document of Needs, you just have to also have to remember and remind yourselves that no pioneer can know your culture as well as you know it. No pioneer is going to learn your local language as well as you know it. No one is going to be able to do quite what you can do. And I just want to share this excerpt from a letter written on behalf of The Guardian that comments on this point. Great as are the services rendered by pioneers, and unforgettable as are the deeds they accomplish, they cannot take the place of the indigenous element which must constitute the bedrock of the community. Friends, the tasks of this five-year plan are as great and as awe-inspiring as the tasks of the earlier chapters of the Divine Plan. We are to bring the transforming influence of the Institute process and a rich spiritualized community life to people in hundreds of clusters and eventually thousands of clusters between now and 2021. And we also have the many thousands where we don't have Baha'is even settled as yet. And of course, it's beyond now opening places to the faith. What we're striving, obviously, to do is to lay a strong foundation for a new civilization. You are, in fact, potential civilization builders wherever you go. If you do arise to pioneer, be inspired by these words of Abdu'l-Bahá in the Tablets of the Divine Plan, addressed to those responding to his call. Should you be aided to render such a service, rest ye assured that the diadem of everlasting sovereignty will be on your heads. And at the threshold of oneness, you will be the favored and accepted servants. Thank you.